This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM, and we're having some problem with the line. I hope the line is good now. Yes? Still holding steady? Jesse back in the studio? We're good? So we don't know what the problem is. Sometimes when you're connecting across state lines, going through various switch boxes with the phone company, maybe there was a fireworks problem in one of the displays somewhere. Anyway, there was a problem getting connected. We were connected last hour. We were talking off the air, and then we're getting ready to go on the air, and then boom. We had our own mid-air explosion, so to speak. And I'm not totally ooky spooky over every coincidence, but I'll tell you about one that just happened at the top of the hour. And maybe George Norrie is right that there are no such things as coincidences, although I tend to believe there are. But here's one that was kind of weird. I hadn't heard from a friend of mine, Dr. David Penchansky, in a long time. He'd been out of town. He's an author, and he's a friend of mine. He's a professor near where I live, and he writes these really interesting books about the Bible. So I had had him on Coast to Coast before when this issue came up about the number 666 being the number of the beast, that actually, if we did the translation correctly, the number should be 616, not 666. And I was just thinking about that because I'd gotten an email from my friend David just today. He wrote to say, "I'm probably your only fan listening live from Saudi Arabia. It's great to have your familiar voices when I'm so far from home. Technology is great." Signed, my friend David. So I was just going to actually read that at the beginning of the hour. It's kind of a shout out to David listening to Saudi Arabia. And then, boom, we couldn't get connected. And the weirdest little coincidence of all the tapes that they have in the backup file that's cocked and loaded and ready to go in case of emergency, it's the one time I had him on Coast to Coast talking about the sign of the beast. So how weird is that? I mean, that's just so anyway, if David were listening in Saudi Arabia, that must have been very shocking for him to have heard that. And for everybody else who was waiting to hear a live show here on the 4th of July, we still haven't quite figured it out. We're really running on just one of our two units. We usually have a backup ready to go in case one of them should crash. As you have heard, sometimes one of them does. It's rare that both of them do. And they both did just before we were to go live here on Coast to Coast AM. So that's behind us now. We hope we'll continue to drive it home on one headlight. We took our break already, so we're just going to keep on rolling. But if we go down again, we'll go to a backup, and we'll just have to play it by ear. Now, is it surprising terribly that on the 4th of July we should have some sort of strange transmission and what happens? I don't know. I was at a party earlier. Hi to Tom and Kathleen and all the families that gather once a year. And we did something that we've never done before. In fact, I'm not even quite, I know it's not legal. I'm not sure whose idea it was. I know it wasn't mine. But at this party, this backyard party I was attending, somebody brought in a quarter stick of dynamite. I'm not exaggerating. It was a quarter stick of dynamite. It came from some industrial use somewhere, I guess. Somebody has a handy quarter stick of dynamite laying around, and somebody gave it to one of the patrons of the party who thought it'd be fun to stick it in a watermelon. So it just so happens that our friends Tom and Kathleen have this nice property next to their house, about one large acre. Sort of bowl-shaped, actually. It's kind of perfect for a launching pad for bottle rockets and things like that. But we put a watermelon in the middle of this. We put the quarter... Well, I say we. The adults in the group did put a quarter stick of dynamite inside the watermelon. I was standing off to the side, ready to beat a hasty retreat if the cops showed up. Because suddenly I was 14 again. I was just waiting for the police to surround the joint. Anyway, so they put a quarter stick of dynamite in the middle of the watermelon and a little fuzzy bunny on top of the watermelon, lit the fuse, and I am not exaggerating when I said the watermelon atomized. It disappeared. it didn't blow chunks up in different directions, recognizable chunks. Whereas, like, oh, wow, look at that. There's some donut, there's some, you know, watermelon shrapnel over there or anything. Nothing. It was gone. Completely disappeared from the face of the earth. It was like Perugia somehow. It was like Armageddon. Suddenly they were calling the watermelon home, and it was there one moment, and then we were all left behind. It was gone. And that little bunny was the first stuffed bunny in space, I believe. It didn't go as far as I thought, but it sure went for a little bit of a ride. And anyway, there you go. That was my 4th of July. So maybe something like that happened at one of the switching boxes here for the lines we use to connect up to coast to coast. I can't blame somebody for doing that somewhere, because that's what we were doing too. Job well done, by the way, on last week's show. I'll get back to that in just a second. I'll tell you, coming up next hour, it's going to be really good. I'm really looking forward to counterterrorism expert Fred Burton. The book is Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent, and you will hear these confessions coming up live next hour on Coast to Coast. In the first hour of Coast to Coast last week, you might have heard investigative reporter Peter Lance came on to talk about the need to send a message to U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald, who may have been able to prevent 9/11 if he had treated an important investigation better by buying a paperback copy of Peter's book, Triple Cross. Peter argued that this would be a great way to send a message that U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald should not attempt to quash a book or get a book pulped, as they say, by threatening a lawsuit. So for the price of a couple of hamburger meals, Peter Lance was asking for Coasties to step up and grab the new paperback to keep his well-researched charges alive, and who knows, maybe even get somebody in Washington to reopen the investigation. Now, I would just say this was one of the most amazing turnouts. All of you delivered. Peter Lance came on the air for about 10 minutes. When he did, the new paperback version of Triple Cross was ranked on Amazon somewhere around the 20,000s. The thousands. So way down on the list. It had just come out earlier in the week, and it was down around 20,000 for sales. Within an hour of him being on the air on Coast to Coast for 10 minutes, it was in the 1,000s on the bestseller list. And before the night was over, Triple Cross was in the top 150 of paperbacks overall that had been sold. But importantly, it was number one on the separate lists of best-selling espionage books, number one on books about terrorism, and number one under books about government. Three separate lists it was number one on. Of those lists, as I remember it, on one of those lists at least, the paperback of Triple Cross was ranked number one, just ahead of the hardback copy of Triple Cross at number two. So amazing, all in a five-hour period. And on Monday morning, believe me, everybody at HarperCollins was taking notice of the power of Coast to Coast, I promise you. And I'll put the link up on my blog here in case you missed it and you want to buy a copy of that book. It's a great read and really good this summer. Now, tonight, the subject is counterterrorism. And one glance around the news demonstrates that we should be mindful of the shadowy work of ghosts like Fred Burton. Did you see the video going around the net of a four-shot novelty pistol that is disguised as a cell phone? It might get screened out at an airport checkpoint through an X-ray machine, but I don't think your average security guard would ever be suspicious of somebody waving it at a political rally. It looks like a cell phone. Or maybe backstage at some celebrity fundraiser. Nobody would notice. You'd be somebody standing there with a cell phone. Nobody would know that it was a gun. This transformer-like pistol-turned-cell-phone is just another challenge for anybody charged with keeping us safe from terrorists or any would-be assassin, for that matter. And when I get the blog up here in just a minute, I'll link the video so you can go see it for yourself. Now, if you want to see a positive kind of conversion, albeit one that's a little more expensive, you must see this church in England that's been remodeled into a beautiful home. Some people find that kind of thing blasphemous. You know, the idea of a church being used for something other than for church work, or, you know, God forbid somebody should make it a bedroom and that there's actual sex going on or something like that. I love church architecture in general, especially the Gothic kind, and I think it's a sin to see anybody tear down something this special once it has been deconsecrated. So I'll put up the link for this story. Oh, by the way, the best part about that church turned home, it comes with its own graveyard. I'd pay extra. And finally, because of my love of dogs, I'll pass along another link, another weak link, if you will. Three dogs fending off an alligator. I'll put that up on my blog coming up in just a moment at coasttocoastam.com. All of those in just a second. Now, there's one story we had linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and when I went to it, I couldn't find anything more about it. I just saw the headline about an American who had announced his theory that the image on the Shroud of Turin was that of Leonardo da Vinci. And I thought, okay, well, where have we heard that before? And Lynn Picknett joins us. She's the co-author with Clive Prince of Turin Shroud, in whose image the truth behind the centuries-long conspiracy of silence. And we asked nicely, and she agreed to come on Coast to Coast AM at the last minute and talk about that. Lynn, are you there okay?
I am indeed, Ian. And you did ask very nicely.
Well, and it's only appropriate that we should have a Brit on for the 4th of July.
I know. No. I mean, in the neighborhood here, lots of Americans live around here, and the fireworks last night, they were amazing.
Were they? So it's sort of a nice way of just sort of remembering our divorce, anniversary of our divorce. So, Lynn, I mean, you were the first person that I know of that espoused the theory that the image captured on the Shroud of Turin was Leonardo da Vinci. And we'll have time to get into all of that coming up after the bottom of the hour. But set the table for me a little bit. Have you heard about this new news story of somebody saying that this is a new idea?
Well, it actually arose from a British television program, which I think was also on Discovery Channel a while back or something like that. We were interviewed for the program, Clive Prince and I.
Okay.
It was actually Dr. Lillian Schwartz who came out and backed us up, although it wasn't presented like that. It was presented as if we had the idea and she did all the work, which actually wasn't true.
Well, I know it wasn't true because I read your book 15 years ago.
Yes, quite. 1994. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say this, too, and I went to the link on our webpage, and our link didn't work to the story, so I couldn't get any more details. So being the kind of lazy guy I am, I thought, well, I could go sussing around trying to find it, or I'll just call Lynn.
Yep, it makes sense.
But help us with that. So this was based on a recent story that was on TV, and I hadn't heard it, that makes the claim, sort of reinvigorating this argument that you made a while ago.
Yeah, so, the program was on here on last Wednesday, and it was called The Da Vinci Shroud Revealed.
Okay, so love all of that. And now, why is it being revealed for the first time? How can they even kind of with a straight face talk about it being revealed?
People forget very quickly, especially in the media, you know, constantly that the Shroud, people are coming up with, quote, new ideas when they're not new at all, you know.
Okay. And so in this case, these aren't Shroudies that are doing it. These are people, and we should be clear, Shroudies is the term being used generally for people that argue for the authenticity of it being Christ's image on the... Okay, and we'll go through that coming up in just a second on your theory, which is getting revisited here in some new work on TV and stuff. Is there a new book out about this too?
No, there isn't. No, it's the same old book. Actually, there's an update in the UK, but I'm afraid not in the States at the moment. It's called Turin Shroud, In Whose Image?
Okay, so in the meantime, here's what we're going to do during the bottom of the hour, okay? I'm going to kind of get recollected here after we had a technical error toward the beginning of the hour. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the image then, as you argue it, on how that could be Leonardo da Vinci's face on the Turin Shroud. I'm going to ask people to go to my blog at coasttocoastam.com. And Lynn, if you go there too, you'll see a picture of my dog.
Oh, I'd love to.
I put up a little picture of my dog there, dressed up for the 4th of July. So if you want to there, and then there's some interesting links. Okay, so very good. We'll come back to that then in just a minute. Lynn Picknett for the rest of this hour on the Turin Shroud Revisited. And then Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent. Next hour, you don't want to miss Fred Burton there. And thank you, everybody, for bearing with us during those earlier technical difficulties. If by replaying that old show, you were interested in the topics that night, you know what? It might be worth revisiting sometime in the future, too. It's been a while since we've done a diet show, and they're always interesting when they present some new material. So that could be happening, too, coming up sometime this summer on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so I'm telling you, it's like poltergeists in the studio tonight. The computer that ordinarily comes on with that fabulous Ross Mitchell announcement, you're listening to Coast AM with Ian Punnett. That's not working. That's melted down too. So whatever it is that's going on, it may be kind of a bumpy ride tonight. So as I said before, we'll be driving it home with one headlight at least for a while, but I'd buckle up even in the back seat. Who knows what'll happen? All I know for sure is we've got Lynn Picknett here, and we'll get back to the Turin Shroud story, the new old story of how the truth behind the centuries-long conspiracy of silence around the Shroud of Turin is that it was Leonardo da Vinci. Before there was the Da Vinci Code, there was this photograph, and I say that quite intentionally, a photograph, which explains how it got on the Shroud. And we'll get back to that coming up next. Before we talk to the counterterrorism expert Fred Burton next hour on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Yeah, well, okay, as if that isn't all weird enough, I went to the links on my blog at coasttocoastam.com, and none of them are working either. So, you know, the night of strange disconnects continues. I better get in this interview here with Lynn Picknett before we lose that too. Lynn, the book is Turin Shroud. Is it still available, by the way, for purchase?
Well, I believe so. I mean, you can always find it somewhere if you really try, I'm sure.
Well, it's such a great book. I just didn't know whether the publishers were still treating you right in terms of keeping it in print.
I've no idea, to be honest, about the States. As I say, certainly in the UK, there's an update of 2 years ago. But the Americans so far are not interested in the update. But I think you might be now. Big hint, if possible.
Yeah, really? Well, I would. And if I were them, and I think this is really important, I mean, what you've got here was you had a scoop.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a really compelling argument. Mm. Now, let's go over some of what you and Clive Prince, your writing partner, had come up with. And by the way, if anybody ever wants to see Lynn and Clive in the flesh, they still are in print in the Da Vinci Code movie. They're sitting on the bus.
Yep.
In one of the scenes. So the idea here is that Leonardo da Vinci, as part of just kind of the overall coolness of Leonardo da Vinci, he was into the earliest form of photography long before anybody else was.
I mean, it's known from his notebooks that he built a camera obscura, which is basically just a little box, very, very simple sort of box camera thing. Just a box, basically, with light and a homemade lens. You talk about him being cool. It's known that he ground his own lenses and made himself some very cool dark blue shades, actually. He was really into trying to... He loved trying to understand how sight worked, eyes worked. He loved how light worked. You know, he loved trying to capture the most lifelike image. And so if it were possible, of course, for him, he would have been into photography. And he certainly was. As I say, in his notebooks, there's the very basic kind of camera obscura drawings. He made his own.
Well, you got to love that. And then on top of that, he had... He would have had the kind of sense of humor or the sort of sensibility that would have allowed him to, would have encouraged him to try something as audacious as this.
Well, certainly. I mean, Leonardo, or as people call him these days, Da Vinci, which is completely wrong. But I mean, he was well known in his day for being an illusionist and a conjurer. And, you know, he broke the ice at parties, you know. He was, and he had a very wicked sense of humour. But in this particular instance, there are heavy hints that he was employed by a very cynical Vatican to produce the ultimate relic, in quotes. I mean, I have to say, because somebody is going to point this out if I don't, that there was a, quote, holy shroud around about 100 years before Leonardo was born, but it was a blatant painted fake. And then it disappeared, and suddenly a shroud appeared during Leonardo's time, very close to where he was working at the time, and there's no paint on it. So obviously this was a substitute for the previous one.
Right. And so let's paint the picture, if you will, of what would have been in the – why was it in anybody's interests to engage Leonardo to create a fake?
Well, in those days, we're talking about the sort of mid-late 15th century in Europe, relics, holy relics, were absolutely the big thing. I mean, cities, whole cities had their great relic, and, you know, thousands of pilgrims would come and pray over it and, of course, put their gold into the church's coffers and line the pockets of the priests. And so it was big business. It was as simple as that. It was big business. And, you don't get a bigger relic than one that purportedly shows the image of Jesus himself.
And this image of Jesus that you would argue is what we've come to accept as an image of Jesus on the Shroud of Turin actually works when we superimpose it over images of Leonardo da Vinci.
Exactly. No, the thing about, well, I'll tell you what happened. 1988, the shroud was carbon dated, and it was shown to be late medieval or early Renaissance fake. So Clive and I came along, and we thought, well, it is the most remarkable fake ever. Because it, you know, it's not a painting, and nobody knew how it was done. And when seen in photographic negative, it sort of leaps into this horrendous detail of a truly sort of crucified man. And we set ourselves the task. I mean, it sounds very stupid actually looking back, of trying to find out who did it and how. But actually, the shroudies, the believers, gave us two major hints. They said if it was a fake, and obviously they didn't believe it was, it could only have been created by somebody of the, you know, in the category of the genius Leonardo da Vinci. And so we thought, okay, we'll begin with him, if only just to rule him out. And what happened then was we knew very little about him, apart from the fact he was a genius, got a book out of the library, turned the pages, there were portraits of Leonardo, and we went, oh no, that's the man on the shroud. So it was as simple as that, and we didn't sort of go into print immediately and foolishly like that. I mean, we spent a lot of time thinking about this, a lot of time looking into it, to say the least. And we came to realise that the head image, the face image, is completely separate from the rest of the body. And because, a very long story short, the image was put together in three phases. The face down to the bottom of the neck, the rest of the front of the image, and the whole of the back separately. And, you know, basically also the believers had said the image behaves like a photograph. So we thought, okay, let's suppose it's a photograph. And we were the first people ever to reproduce all the so-called miraculous characteristics of the shroud, but simply by, you know, using a few very, very basic chemicals, a lot of light, and this little camera obscura.
And this camera obscura is something you all kind of recreate for the book Turin Shroud. And do they do the same thing for this TV special that's just out?
Well, no, we didn't. And I have to say, we were a little annoyed because, this show presented us as the people who had an idea, and then other people came along and actually proved it with their hands on. In fact, we proved it. We were the first people to build the camera obscura and do this. So it was a little bit annoying because it wasn't even mentioned that we'd done the actual work.
Right. Which you authenticate in the book.
Yes, absolutely. Which
you show beginning to end, right?
And we also tell everybody out there, you know, how to do it themselves. You know,
right.
if you want to reproduce, you know, just use a still image of a bust of, you know, plaster bust or something, and we explain how to do it.
And so it didn't require anything. I mean, it doesn't require holograms. It doesn't require anything to be able to get the image onto a cloth from something like the, you know, if you used the bust of Mozart that's on your piano. You could create an image on a shroud that looks like the death mask of Mozart.
Yep, and it will look more lifelike in negative, just like the Turin shroud. It will also have the strange features of the shroud. For example, there's a sort of fisheye effect in the middle, and the ears disappear. If you look at the image of the shroud, the man has no ears. There are blank strips down the side, and then very curious outline of hair, which should be falling back from the face if the man's lying down, but actually it frames the face. And we worked out why, because when we did our experiments, the way, you know, the whole modus operandi creates this image that is fisheye effect with no ears, and you have to actually paint on hair round it because the hair has fallen, you know, back. It's not shown, and everything fell into place once we'd done it. And you know, we also discovered that in our images, the image of the lens itself is shown in the dead centre of the image, which, if you're just doing a head, is the centre of the nose. And because we believe that the evidence is that the head image was created of the shroud itself was created separately from the rest, we just looked at it, and there in the center of the nose is the dark circle of the lens. So Leonardo used a lens. It was created photographically. And of course, the big thing, as far as we're concerned, is that the face is that of himself.
Right.
So, although it sounds completely mad, especially, you know, this time in the morning for me, but believe me, it isn't, that this man was a genius. He was a very curious-minded man. And that basically what we have is a 500-year-old photograph of Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, wow.
And none of that should be, I mean, here on a 4th of July weekend in the United States, where we are... we are conscious of the founding fathers, as we call them, and the people like Benjamin Franklin, who, while also being a revolutionary in a political sense, in a social sense, he was definitely also one as a scientist and laid the groundwork for, you know, the discovery, the harnessing of electricity.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, and various, like a million little inventions that he had along the way. So he's kind of like the American Leonardo da Vinci. We look at him as a Renaissance man in the same way that we would think of Leonardo, in that, you know, he had his fingers and everything, and he could spin off a creation on a Thursday, you know, just get it done, get it fed, and then be publishing, you know, the almanac, you know, for the Poor Richard's Almanac the next week. And he just had that kind of a mind. So we shouldn't think it's that bizarre to think that Leonardo da Vinci would have done something like this, because Ben Franklin would have done something like this if it hadn't done.
Well, yes. And I mean, you know, lots of people say to us, well, you know, if Leonardo had really done this, then surely, you know, it would be evidence in his notebooks, or there would be sort of failed shrouds knocking around, you know, for us to find. Well, the answer to that is that actually the whole, what we would call, you know, early photographic technique was particularly frowned on by the Catholic Church at the time, which ruled every aspect of life throughout Europe. And they really, anybody who had, you know, like Leonardo, had experimented with projecting images and, you know, blah-de-blah, all that kind of thing, very simple stuff, we would think. But they were actually accused of sorcery. So Leonardo had to keep this secret. He couldn't leave his notebooks lying around with his experimental stuff in it. You know, it's just ridiculous to think that.
Well, and also he could have been paid for his silence. I mean, it could have been something that that he was that, you know, the, in order for it to be an effective tourist generating vehicle, it had to be accepted as truth. And so if there's a little extra on the side to, you know, this doesn't show up in your notebooks, nobody mentions this. You know, that should, and no one should be surprised about that.
No, that's true. That's very true. But let me just tell you what to Clive and I is like the biggest joke. And this is almost certainly in Leonardo's head when he set out. He used what was essentially a forbidden technique, you know, the photographic technique, to create the great holy relic, which, of course, he was quite right in supposing would go down throughout history, generation after generation, protected by the church.
Right.
So basically, he was using the church that hated photography to look after his evidence of photography, so that maybe one day, you know, in the future, somebody would come along and say, "Oh, look, it's a Leonardo and it's a photograph," and we have. Here we are.
Right. Now that's the original Da Vinci code right there.
Yeah.
I mean, that may be the The Smoking Gun. All right, so again, we're talking with Lynn Picknett, co-author of Turin Shroud, this book that has attracted new attention, despite the fact that it's been out for 15 years. And I read it breathlessly when it first came out, and I still love it. I still keep it on my shelf. I was probably going through it not a year ago again, just pleasure reading it, because I think it makes such a compelling case for the creation of the Turin Shroud as something that was done at the hand of Leonardo da Vinci. Now, just while we have 2 minutes left, explain some of the aspects of the body of the shroud and why you think that that the body itself, how the body is laid out on the shroud and how it appears, how that also to you indicates that this was a forgery.
Well, for a start, the man is ludicrously tall. It's something that the believers don't really mention. He's actually 6'8" at the front and 6'10" at the back. And on two counts, that's rather strange. Yeah. You know, nowhere in the Bible does it say that Jesus was not only a giant, but actually was 2 inches taller at the back than the front. And also, at the head at the back image is at an entirely different angle to at the front, which shows that it was A, a projected image, so it was could be any height, and B, the front and back images were created at a different time. And also there's a line at the base of the neck at the front, which shows the head image was created separately from the rest. There are lots of other things. And what I mean, basically, yes, the body from the neck down was indeed that of a genuinely crucified man. But then Leonardo da Vinci had access to all sorts of bodies for his anatomical research. So he could have, you know, strung any corpse up, really, and no doubt he did.
Well, okay, but let's go back to that, though. I mean, any crucified man, he could have strung anybody up. He could have gotten a body easily from his research. We know that because he was doing these anatomical drawings of, you know, the layers of muscle tissue, et cetera. He was heavily into that. Why couldn't that have been the image of Jesus, just to address the issue, why couldn't that have been the image of Jesus stretched out after having been crucified on the cross that gives the appearance of being 6'8"?
As I just said, it's highly unlikely that even Jesus would be, you know, have his chin down at the front and be looking straight out, as it were, except of course the eyes are closed, and at the back at the back at the same time would have his head right tilted right back. Right. Also the big, I mean, and also, you know, the head is completely separate from the body, so, you know, Jesus wasn't beheaded. And the other thing is that quite clearly, because of the nature of the image, which obviously we go into all this in great detail in the book, but this cloth never wrapped a body. You know, if it had been, you know, if so, when the cloth had been straightened out, the image would be very distorted. But it's actually, no, it's a projected image, and we have proved it 100%, you know, by our hands-on research. This is what you do, and this is the kind of image you get when you do it.
Okay, very good. Again, the book is Turin Shroud. If you can find it, grab it. The book reveals who created the shroud, the identity of the face of the shroud, how the shroud was created, and the connections among the shroud, alchemy, and the invention of photography, and a conspiracy of one of the world's most secret societies, which is, it's such a great read, and nice that you're getting attention through this new television special. I wish that you were getting the attention for having done all of the heavy lifting on this when you did so long ago.
Oh, well, thank you, Ian. It makes so much difference having you there.
Okay, good. Well, you know, I'll always be an advocate for you, Lynn. God bless you, and have a nice 4th of July weekend, such as it is.
And you too.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you.
And coming up, Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent, Fred Burton, on the way next hour. I went back into my blog and I repaired all of the, the connections, all of the links, which had, for whatever reason, amongst all of our other technical problems tonight, had somehow gotten disconnected. So if you go back on, if you want to take a look at it, there's some interesting stuff in there, including this cell phone that turns into a gun. Or is it a gun that turns into a cell phone? Go look at how fast this gun can be assembled and then fired, and how believable it would be if somebody were just standing there at some security checkpoint with that. You would never expect that was a weapon. It just goes to show you some of the challenges that are facing counterterrorism agents out there, as well as security people everywhere. You find out more on that if you go to coasttocoastam.com and then click on the link that takes you to my blog, A Gun That Looks Like a Cell Phone. And it might have come in handy for somebody like a Fred Burton. He carried a list in his pocket. We'll talk about the names on that list and what that list represented. And then we'll talk about exactly who it is that he's confessing to. We'll get back to this next. Ghost. Tell you the details that could be revealed for the first time on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.